This podcast episode, while not explicit, contains some gruesome details about violence that may be troubling for some listeners to hear. Listener discretion is advised.
Creepy Life Podcast, a podcast with a wide variety of creepy topics for all your true crime, paranormal, and otherwise spooky needs. I'm Thomas.
I'm Sparky. And it's Sunday evening. We're going to jump right in, I think. So I'm going to tell you a story about Jennifer Pan and her family. And I'm not going to give you any more details than that.
Okay. Wait, do I know this story?
You might be familiar with it, but I doubt you've heard much of the details. I'd heard, like, the general story, but I didn't know any of the detail before I started.
Well, alrighty then. Let's do it.
My source is Case File Podcast, episode 50, and I'm going to use that partway through for you, Thomas, because they have the 911 call on there. I'm going to make you listen to it.
Alright.
Toronto Life, APA.org, YouTube, Toronto.com. Wikipedia, and the Toronto Star.
So I don't know why, but I'm thinking this is a Canadian story.
This story has really brief mentions of self-harm, suicidal intent, and assault, but they're only, like, briefly mentioned, just so you know. So, the Pan family. There's Han. That's the dad. The mom's name is Bika. There's Jennifer, the daughter, and Felix, the son. And if you want to see it more from, like, a personal point of view, the Toronto Life article that was written by Karen K. Ho, who was a classmate of one of the children. I know, Karen Ho.
How fitting that in this day and age, you don't know what a Karen is? Just Google 2020 Karen.
It's both of our mothers.
It's both of our mothers.
Disclaimer. No, but, like, literally,
that's what I mean. we're not making fun of them. Our moms are named Karen.
Both of them. We're siblings, and we have lesbian mothers. That's a lie.
Yeah, because I'm very much a dude, and I've been thinking you were a chick this whole time. Am I wrong?
What's that got to do with having lesbian parents?
You said we were twins. Or no, you said we were siblings. Never mind. I'm so confused as to what is going on.
I don't know either. It's just so weird. Alright, so Han was born in Vietnam, immigrated to Canada in 1979 as a political refugee, and there he met Bika, and they got married apparently really soon after that. She was also there for the same reason, basically. She immigrated there for safety. Married sometime in the early 1980s in Toronto. They lived in Scarborough. They both worked at Magna International, which is a car company. Alright, so both of them made car parts. Han made tools and dye, and Bika made car parts.
Cool.
So, their first child, Jennifer, was born in 1986. Their second child, Felix, was born in 1989. Good year.
Or so you think.
They were very frugal with their money. They'd saved, and they were able to buy a really nice car and home in Markham, which is north of Toronto, which is in Ontario. They also had a pretty decent chunk of savings. And they wanted to have their kids live like they did, but do better, which I think is what most...
I think, yeah, generally parents always want better for their kids than what they had.
Yeah. At least you hope so.
Except for me. If I have kids, I don't want them to be as smart as I am.
Oh my God.
I don't want them to be as good-looking as I am. I don't want them to be as talented as I am. So basically, they're going to be blank humans devoid of personality.
Your head is growing. Your ego is amazing.
Yes, thank you. My ego makes up for my lack of self-esteem.
So they expected them to work hard and be responsible. Jennifer started piano lessons at age 4, And she won some awards from her playing. And her parents continually pushed her to do better and do more. So Jennifer also took skating lessons, and she was aiming for the 2012 Olympics for ice skating.
Wow.
2010. But she tore a ligament in her knee.
Ow.
Yeah, which it's so like sad how something so simple can ruin somebody's career aspirations. So her parents did push her a lot, but it was because they wanted the best for her, like we said. And her mother would go on the defense for her if her father was too hard on her. So I think her mom's kind of more realistic, like, yeah, we want her to do good, but don't, like, we don't want her mental health to suffer because of it, you know what I mean? And her mom would comfort her when her father went to sleep and would just tell her, we want you to do your best. However, her father was a tiger parent, which is a phrase that means a parent who pushes their child to excel in everything. And typically they punish mediocre performance.
And, that sounds great.
Right. Apparently a big reason for doing it is they want to have something to brag about to their friends, which is great.
Oh, definitely.
So according to a study done in 2011, yes, that was the whole study.
Oh, that's good to know.
So according to a study done in 2011, it actually doesn't have the desired outcome. Big surprise.
Wow.
I know.
I never would have guessed.
I know. The desired outcome would be being great at everything and having an amazing self-esteem and being Captain Awesome and Chuck who does nothing wrong.
But the reality is a homicidal maniac that burns down the school?
Typically, the children are very depressed, and they end up actually suffering academically because they realize they can never live up to the expectations set by their parents. Their mental health suffers from it. So, sidebar, the study that said that that was not a great way to parent said that the best type of parenting was supportive. I know, right? Which is good, so thanks, Mom and Dad, love you. It's also, I wanted to point out a term that's used a lot in teaching and how it kind of relates, helicopter parenting.
Here comes the egghead.
So if you've never heard of helicopter parents, they basically are the parents that kind of hover around their child all the time. And it's usually used in a negative context because they want to do everything for their child. And they want to see every single thing they're doing. And they typically are kind of Karens about grades and opportunities and things like that. Well, my child tried hard, so they deserve a trophy kind of thing. Yeah, it's not necessarily a bad thing. You know, it's not bad to care about your children, but it's overbearing. And it can be damaging to your relationship with your child. And it's also really overwhelming for teachers, just so you know. Okay, anyway. Her dad really closely monitored her grades and extracurriculars, and he also forbade her from doing any dating or going to dances until she had a degree, because having fun was not productive.
Isn't there a, was it a study or something I read that basically leisure time can help stimulate you enough that you can actually succeed?
Mm-hmm.
Keeps you from chronic burnout?
Yeah. Again, like we were saying, this is kind of an old-fashioned viewpoint. Like, of work hard and you'll get everything that you want. Rather than being realistic in today's economy. /COVID.
Work hard and you'll still be a grunt at the same place you've worked at for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Which is not always the case, but sometimes that's what it feels like. So while she was in elementary school, she started to feel crushed by pressure. She was doing school, skating practice, and she was going to sleep at midnight in elementary school. A lot of my students go to bed between 7 and 8. Like, that's not good.
Wow.
And, disclaimer for stuff, she started cutting herself. Just like a little small cut so no one would really see it. But by the end of grade 8, she was still really pushing herself. She was expecting to receive a bunch of awards and be a valedictorian. But she wasn't, and she got no awards. And that pretty much killed her motivation for school. And she still, you know, didn't want anybody to worry about her, so she wore, like, a happy mask. Everything's fine, you know, whatever. She attended Mary Ward Catholic Secondary in Scarborough for high school. And during year 9, she was getting average scores in all subjects, but she used her old report cards to forge straight A's to show her parents during her 9th and 10th years of school. Okay, so in grade 11, she met Daniel Chi Kwong Wong, who was a grade 12, and he was kind and social. They started dating in the summer of 2003, and she said, this was really sweet, she said it was because when she was having an asthma attack, he coached her through her breathing and helped her to calm down. And I thought that was really sweet. Not speaking from personal experience, asthma sucks. But he wasn't like a super sunshines and puppies kind of guy. He was arrested at least once for drug trafficking. Police found half a pound of weed in his car.
As high school kids are often charged with.
Mm-hmm. Mid-year, he transferred to another school. Also, in grade 11, Jennifer received an acceptance to Ryerson University. However, the offer was withdrawn when she failed calculus, and she wasn't able to graduate because of it. She didn't want her parents to know, because if they found out about that, they would start digging and looking at her other grades and realize, oh, the school's files are different than what we have, so you've been lying about your grades for years. So she told them she was going to go to Ryerson for 2 years, and then she was going to transfer into pharmacology at U of T, which I believe is University of Toronto. But that's one of those things where there's like a million MSUs. You know, you never know which one is which.
Yeah.
Her dad was so happy that he bought her a laptop. And she forged papers saying she had received a scholarship and loans. And for 2 years, she pretended to go to college. She took public transit to public libraries. And she would go on the internet and, like, look up things about, like, pharmaceuticals and just write notes in her notebook for hours. Every day.
Yeah, that's not normal.
No, it's not. Like, it really would just be easier to just admit that you had lied and get it fixed. Or, like, figure out a way to go back and just do a calculus class. This is just so much unnecessary effort. Sometimes she would go to cafes, or she would just go visit her boyfriend Daniel. He was going to York University, like, actually. She started working as a server and a piano tutor, and later as a bartender. And when her dad would ask her about school, again, her mom came to her defense and said, basically, mind your own business. She's doing what she needs to do. So, sidebar, her younger brother was in school for mechanical engineering at McMaster, so he wasn't at home during this time, and he would not have known what she was doing. Like, he wouldn't be able to see, oh, she's lying, you know?
Yeah.
To keep up appearances, and so no one would catch her, she lied to her friends, too. And she said, you know, she told them she was going to college, but she also lied about her family, and said that her dad had hired a private investigator to follow her. And obviously, this wasn't true, or he would have known that she wasn't going to college.
Perhaps paranoia?
Yeah, and I think she just wanted people to feel bad for her, like saying that her parents were very controlling.
Yeah, I can see that.
So after the 2 years at Ryerson were up, she kept it up literally the whole 2 years, she convinced them she was going to still transfer to another school. They convinced her to live with her friend Topaz, which, by the way, is an awesome name, 3 nights a week for a shorter commute. However, do you want to guess where she stayed those nights instead?
I'm guessing with her boyfriend.
Exactly. And she lied to his family as well, saying that of course her parents were fine with her being there, but anytime they asked to meet them, she said no. She came up with an excuse.
That's suspicious.
Mm-hmm. And she knew that her lies were, like, getting out of hand. They're, like, way out of hand at this point. You know, she couldn't tell the truth because she'd lose everything. And if her parents found out, and then subsequently their community found out, they would lose a lot of social standing, which was
a big deal.
Yeah. So, because she needed to make her life more complicated, apparently, she now started telling her parents that she was volunteering in the labs at a hospital that was literally called Sick Kids Hospital. It's like a children's hospital, in case you couldn't tell.
It is literally called Sick Kids Hospital, and that wasn't just something she made up and her parents bought it.
No, it's an actual hospital.
Sick Kids Hospital.
Yeah, it's one word, sick kids. So, because she was doing this volunteering, she should spend more time at Topaz's house, right?
Absolutely.
Her dad noticed that she had no uniform or ID for the hospital, though. Uh-oh. Dun dun dun. He said they were dropping her off at the hospital for the next day's volunteering. So, when they got there, as soon as they stopped the car, Jennifer ran inside and hid for hours until her parents were gone. Early the next morning, her parents called Topaz, who said Jennifer was not there, obviously. When she eventually got home, the truth kind of came out. She admitted that she was not volunteering at Sick Kids, she was not going to the U of M, and that she was living with Daniel during the time that she wasn't at home. But she still didn't tell them that she hadn't finished high school or that she never went to Ryerson. Her dad tried to kick her out, but her mother said, no, she needs a place to live. So they took away her cell phone for 2 weeks and her laptop.
Wait, how old is she?
She's, like, I think, 21 at this point.
And they took away her cell phone and her computer.
Mm-hmm. I think they really just didn't know what to do with her, and I can't really blame them. And they would let her use them sometimes, but, like, when she needed to get a hold of someone or whatever, they would monitor her usage and read her messages when she did. They also made her quit her jobs except for piano tutoring, and they tracked the odometer on the car so she couldn't sneak out.
And she's in her 20s.
Mm-hmm. Eventually, her parents did start giving her a little bit more leeway. Jennifer started taking a calculus class so she could finish high school, which is good. But of course, I'm pretty sure she was hiding this from them because they didn't know that she didn't go to the first college. And of course, she would find time to spend with Daniel, her boyfriend. This is one of my favorite dumb things that she did that she got caught doing. One time, she tried to mold her blankets to make it look like she was in bed and sneak out. But, oops, she had her mom's wallet. And when Bika came looking for it, she noticed that Jennifer was gone. This didn't go well. I want to note that her dad didn't like Daniel anyway because he was half Filipino. And that was wrong, apparently, for some reason. But they ordered her to stop any contact with Daniel and also told her she needed to immediately apply for college in nursing or pharmaceuticals. And for the record, it's not wrong to be dating someone of a different race. Obviously. She was in love with Daniel, but he was really sick of all the dramatics and keeping their relationship a secret. So he broke up with her. And then soon after that, Jennifer learned that he was seeing someone else named Christine. And she tried to win him back using a really weird tale. So this is another disclaimer for assault. If you want to skip ahead, go ahead. A police officer, according to her, came to the door, and when she opened the door, men rushed in and assaulted her. It was not true. She also said that she received a bullet in the mail as a warning from Christine. Again, not true. And she used this to show Daniel that his new girlfriend was no good, and somehow she was supposedly behind these fake crimes, and basically her life is just a giant mess. In case you didn't notice. On November 8th, 2010, Jennifer was at home watching TV. For sure she was watching Gossip Girl, but she might have also been watching John and Kate Plus 8, which is always important. She said goodnight to her parents, and they all went to bed shortly before 10. Shortly after 10, three men armed with guns entered the home. One man went after Bika, another after Han, another after Jennifer. Bika and Han were directed to the living room. Jennifer's arms were tied behind her, and she led the man who tied her up into her bedroom, where she showed him where she had $2,500 hidden that she had saved from piano lessons, then led him to her parents' bedroom, and he took $1,100. While this happened, the other two stayed in the living room with her parents with guns to their faces. And in Cantonese, Bika asked Han how they got in, but the men just yelled at them to be quiet. They yelled at Han to give him money, but he only had $60. So they called him a liar and hit him in the face with the butt of the gun. Ouch.
Ouch indeed. Wait, was this like a handgun or a rifle? Because pistol, it would have been more like a pistol whip, which still would have hurt.
I think, actually, now that you say that, I think it was pistol whip.
Okay, because I can imagine, like, a hunting rifle or something with enough momentum, that would... Ow.
So, Big Cow was crying. She pleaded with them to not hurt her daughter. They basically said, don't worry, she's nice. We won't hurt her. Which is not suspicious at all. Then the attacker with Jennifer took her back to her room and tied her to the banister right outside her room. The other two took Han and Bika to the basement and put blankets over their head. They shot Han twice, once in the shoulder, once in the face, and he fell to the floor. They shot Bika three times in the head. Jennifer could hear the shots, and she managed to get her phone out of her back pocket despite her hands being tied. She called the police and said she needed help and that she didn't know where her parents were, and men had come into the house. She described the robbery and the shots. While she was on the phone with 911, she heard a loud moan, and it was her dad. He was alive. And if you listen to the 911 call, the very beginning of the case file episode has it on there. If you want to hear it, that's a good place to do it. But he had woken up from the shots and crawled up the stairs and ran out of the house. After he ran out of the house, he ran into a neighbor, and he was covered in blood and incoherent, as you can imagine. The neighbor had been on his way to work in the garage, so it was really, like, good timing that he was there at the same time. And so the neighbor called 911 as well. The dispatcher stayed on with Jennifer until the police arrived. And the dispatcher, I thought, just in the recording they played, was really kind and assured her, you know, hey, you're doing a good job, you're doing everything right, you know. Which, that would be an awful job. So if you do that, thank you, but, like, wow. I don't think I could do that. Jennifer asked if the dispatcher could call her aunt and uncle. I believe they had seen them earlier that day. And Han was taken to a hospital and induced into a coma. He was eventually transferred into a trauma unit in another hospital. And unfortunately, Big Ha did die. Thankfully, it was almost instantly, so she didn't have to feel too much pain. At about 3 a.m., the police interviewed Jennifer about what happened, and she told them basically what I told you. The three dudes came in, tied her up, stole a bunch of money, and shot her parents. Detectives noted that she looked young. She looked like she was like 16, and she's actually in her mid-20s at this point. Before we go on, I'm going to have you listen to the 911 call. I play the beginning of the call for Thomas. And basically that part is her calling 911 and you can hear her dad screaming in the background. And she's describing where she is. And the poor dispatcher could not understand what she was saying for her address and had to ask her it a bunch of times. But, yeah.
Yeah.
So 2 days later, they brought Jennifer in for more questioning at the police station and to ask her some clarification questions. She showed them how she was able to get her phone out of her pocket despite her hands being tied, which there's video on YouTube. They started to wonder how true the story was, because as far as they could tell, and according to her story, they had no tools to get in, the people that broke in, they had nothing to carry any loot in, and they had no zip ties to tie her up. She was tied up with a shoelace. The other really big thing that they noticed, there were keys to her dad's Lexus right by the door, in clear view of the door. So if they went through the front door when they left, they should have been able to see it, and they would have stolen the car.
Yeah.
It's too easy to not steal it, honestly. Like, if that's what your goal is, you know. The other thing was, why did they shoot two witnesses and leave one unscathed? So during the first interview, the detective was very kind and assured her she had nothing to be sorry for. Apologized for asking so many questions, but as he continued to interview her over the next couple days, he grew less patient with her because he noticed there were holes in the story. So on November 12th, Han woke up from his coma. I don't want to give a lot of really specific details because it's really gross, but the bullet was stuck and he had a couple broken bones. Surprisingly though, he was coherent and he remembered the whole thing very clearly. He told the police mostly the same details Jennifer had, except he remembered that Jennifer was led around the house without her hands tied, and he could hear Jennifer and one of the men chatting quietly like they were friends. So, because funeral was held on November 15th, this part I didn't really understand, and I tried to kind of look into it, but it kind of confused me. So if you know and you want to explain it to me, that's awesome. If not, that's okay. According to a custom, I think a Chinese custom, which doesn't make sense because I thought they were from Vietnam. I don't know. I wrote Chinese custom. The parents' funerals need to be before their kids. So because father had a funeral shortly before, but I don't know that he was actually dead. This part was very unclear, and I could only find very minimal detail about it.
Interesting.
Yeah, so Big House funeral was on November 15th. Jennifer planned that funeral and her grandfather's funeral. And Jennifer and her brother, Felix, attended the funeral, as did the police. But Han was not able to attend because he was not well enough to be there yet.
Yeah.
After being shot in the face, it's pretty obvious he wasn't going to be there. The police said they watched Jennifer and Felix and noticed that Jennifer wasn't really crying. She would put her head down and act like she was crying, but instead of like mourning and like looking at her mother who is dead, she would just keep looking back at the police.
Yeah, that's not suspicious at all.
Yeah, which I could almost always tell when one of my students did something naughty and I caught them in the middle of something, because I'll look at them and they'll start to walk away, but they keep looking back at me. So it's kind of suspicious for sure. So on November 22nd, the police brought Jennifer in again, so this is a week after the funeral. The police pressured her to tell what had happened, actually. And they essentially said, you lied about college, you lied about high school, you lied about your boyfriend. Why would we think you're not lying now? And she fell forward and started sobbing and said, but what happens to me? So basically admitted right there that, oh yeah, I did do this.
Wow.
So here's what actually happened. In 2010, Jennifer connected with a friend from elementary school named Andrew Montemayor, and while they talked, Andrew admitted that he had fantasized about killing his dad. And that kind of sparked something inside Jennifer, and she was like, oh, I could do that. Because, you know, common thing to just want to do, I guess.
Yeah, totally. That's completely not needing psychological help.
Right. And she started imagining how much better her life would be without her dad. Again, I just want to say, her dad may have been tough, but I think he really wanted what was best for her, you know, and I don't think she was justified in what she did. She was justified to be angry, but not to take it to the extent that she did.
I think maybe just kind of severing contact, going and living your life, I could see that, but not this. She was an adult. She could have gone anywhere. And if her parents tried to follow or tried to do anything to get her back, being an adult, she could have got the authorities to help.
And she had at least $25 in savings.
$2,500.
What did I say?
$25.
Yeah, she had at least $2,000 in savings, which isn't something to sneeze at.
No.
You could probably at least stay in a hotel for a little bit. Andrew, the friend that said he wanted to kill his dad, introduced Jennifer to his roommate named Ricardo. Ricardo and Jennifer met over bubble tea and discussed killing her father while he was in the parking lot at work. Because that's what you discuss when you're drinking bubble tea.
Okay.
And this was also between her piano lessons. So she goes to one student, stops in the middle to discuss a murder plan, and then goes to another student. Because, you know.
Yeah, and piano casual students. They're probably, most of these were probably kids.
Yeah.
You know, 5, 6, 7.
So she claims that she gave Ricardo $1,500. So if she had this money, that would be $4,000.
Yeah.
And said they would talk over the phone to discuss details. And this was in the spring. By early July, she had not had any contact with Ricardo and basically realized she'd been scammed. He claims that she only gave him $200 and that he returned it to her. Okay, so Jennifer had been in contact with Daniel during this time, and they came up with a plan together in August. They would have her parents killed, collect their money, and live together. Daniel gave Jennifer a spare phone and SIM card, and introduced her to a friend named Lenford Homeboy Crawford.
Homeboy.
Homeboy.
Does he know Pillboy?
He said he would do the job for 10K because he knew Daniel and they were friends. But apparently, according to him, the going rate was 20K. So, you know. So homeboy went to the Pan's neighborhood to case the joint, you know. He went on Halloween, which was actually really smart because everyone was in costume.
You could be in costume, you could even loiter, and it wouldn't bring any suspicion.
You could walk around people's backyard and they'd think it was just a prank.
Yeah.
You know? So he didn't look out of place. Which, again, very smart, but don't do that. Anyway. On November 2nd, the murder happened on November 8th, Daniel texted Jennifer and said that he felt for Christine what Jennifer felt for him. Jennifer said that he should call off the hit then, and Daniel was confused, thinking that she had wanted to do this for herself. But she said yes, but she had nowhere to go without him. So she didn't really want to do it if he wasn't going to be a part of it. But she decided not to call it off regardless. Daniel set it up with homeboy. They had it planned for November 5th. But apparently Jennifer had a dinner planned and wouldn't be home in time for her parents' murder.
That would have actually been a smarter alternative.
You'd think.
Because that would at least give her an alibi and make her less of a suspect.
Yeah, that's true. So, she texted on November 8th in the morning and said that would be the day. So, David Milvaganen spoke to Jennifer on the phone that night. He was involved in this as well. After that, she went downstairs from her bedroom, said goodnight, and when she said goodnight, she unlocked the front door so they could walk in. Later, she retracted this, but it makes sense. Because it didn't break any windows or anything.
Honestly, it would have made way much more sense if she had unlocked a window. Windows, you have your windows open, you shut them, you forget to lock one.
But in November in Canada, would you have your windows
unlocked? I don't know, maybe you were burning something. You know, maybe you were cooking and it burnt and you needed to get the smoke out.
Yeah, that's true. So, about 10 o'clock, she spoke to David again on the phone. She turned a light on in an upstairs study and then turned it off shortly after, which was apparently the signal to start. Homeboy David and a man named Eric Carty came in through the front door. Eric was a driver and supposedly plotted the attack. Homeboy and David went after her parents, and Eric went for Jennifer. It's still not known who shot who of her parents, who shot whom, so they can't really say who technically murdered them. This is a part talking about suicide stuff, so if that bothers you, skip ahead. So, during the November 22nd interview, Jennifer admitted that she had hired killers, but at this point she claimed that she hired them to kill her. She said that she felt she was a failure and that she was buried in all of her lies, and she changed her mind and tried to cancel, paying an $8,500 cancellation fee. Again.
So that takes her to 12th.
She's got a lot of money. She could have done this without killing
her. I want to know how she's made $12,500 from being a piano tutor.
She was a piano tutor. She worked in a restaurant. She was a bartender. And she essentially had no bills because she lived with her parents. If she wasn't spending a lot of money on anything else, she could have made pretty good money and had a good savings. Plus, they had savings. And I don't imagine they'd give her a lot of money, but if they were really rich... When did
this happen, exactly?
2010.
2010, okay. In 2010, I started working at a restaurant as a waiter, and I barely made $10,000 a year, including tips.
Right. But according to her, even though she paid a cancellation fee, the messages got mixed, and her parents were attacked instead. Also, she paid $10,000 to have them killed.
So that's 22.5.
Yeah.
She would have had enough money to disappear and have her own life.
Pretty much.
In 2010, with over $20,000, could have easily made it maybe 3 years.
At least a year.
At least, at a minimum, depending what kind of place you're living in.
Mm-hmm. This is more suicide talk. She had apparently tried to kill herself on two separate occasions, but failed. She said that she could have moved out, but she didn't want to abandon her family, and she didn't want them to abandon her. So let's just kill him instead.
She really needed a therapist.
Yeah. She's definitely got some flawed logic here. So the trial began March 19th of 2014. I'm not sure why it was so long after this. Lasted until December of 2014, so it was almost 9 months long. More than 50 witnesses testified, and there were more than 200 pieces of evidence.
Wow.
And that included 100 text messages sent between her and Daniel 6 hours before the killing. Han did testify against his daughter.
Smart.
Mm-hmm. He stated again that when she was walking around the house, her hands were free, and it was possible they were tied after that, maybe when she was tied to the banister, because the police did untie her. Or they cut the shoelace. So she did have her hands tied at some point, but not when she was walking around the house. Jennifer received automatic life in prison with chance for parole in 25 years for her mother's murder. She received the same for her father to be served concurrently, which means at the same time. Daniel, David, and Homeboy received the same.
Good.
So Eric's trial was postponed because his lawyer got sick, and it was ordered that Eric have no communication with any of the other people involved, so he didn't get any tips or anything from them, you know?
Wait a minute. Lawyer got sick, they had to postpone? Rona?
He got the Rona.
Or as you cool kids are saying now, he got the vid.
Nobody says that.
My uncle says that. And I was so confused when he texted that. And I looked it up, and apparently it's like a slang term from, like, teenagers.
So, Eric wasn't allowed to have any communication. Jennifer was not allowed to contact her family, but they could contact her if they wanted to talk to her. But she couldn't initiate communication.
So, probably guessing she didn't get many phone calls.
Probably not. She also was not allowed to contact Daniel at all. Eric was charged later in December 2015. He received 18 years with a chance of parole after 9. And I'm not sure if he got a different sentence just because it was done at a different time. Maybe it was a different judge.
Passable.
Or if it was because he wasn't involved, like, in the actual shooting. But Daniel was charged with life. And he wasn't in the house at all. So I don't know. But, I'm not a lawyer guy. I don't know.
Maybe it's that Daniel was a conspirator. Was the other guy really a conspirator, or was just he, like, a hired wheelman?
Well, he stole money, but I don't think he hurt anybody other than Ty and Jennifer up.
Maybe he didn't know there were actually... Maybe he just thought it was a robbery.
I would doubt that, but...
You never know, though.
Yeah. We don't know, because we're not lawyer guys.
Well, you're not.
So, no, here you go. He pled guilty to conspiring to commit murder.
Oh, okay.
So that answers that question. If I would just read ahead in my notes, I would know.
Or memorize your notes.
Jeez. Yeah, my entire, like, 8 pages. He said that he did that to avoid putting Han through another trial.
That was actually very thoughtful.
Yeah, which was, you know, not that I want to say a murderer was sweet, but it was considerate. He died in prison in 2018 when he was stabbed by another inmate.
Lovely.
Mm-hmm.
Better to be stabbed than Jeffrey Dahmer.
And the rest are still incarcerated. And it'll be another 15 years before any of them are up for... No. Another 20 years, about, before any of them are up for parole. So, her brother Felix moved to the East Coast to get away from the area. I don't blame him. He apparently suffers from depression. Like, how would you not?
Yeah, really.
You lost your entire family. Your mom's dead. I guess he's got his dad still. But your mom's dead. Your only other sibling killed your mom, essentially.
But what's the status of his dad, though? I mean...
I don't know.
Even if he's, like, health-wise fine going through that...
Yeah, it's gotta be pretty traumatizing.
Yeah.
So Han said that he lost a wife and a daughter at the same time. He wanted to sell the house, but no one wanted to buy it because they all knew the story behind it. I don't know if he was ever able to or not. Anyway, Han said that he hopes that Jennifer can grow up to be a good, honest person one day.
Grow up?
Mm-hmm.
She was an adult already.
Yeah. I really think that he just wanted...
What was best, but executed it poorly.
Well, and probably executed it in a way that his family had done for him.
Yeah.
You know, and... I don't think he meant any harm. And I think that it's hard to admit to yourself that your daughter is this terrible person that had your wife murdered. you know, you want to believe that she's going to be better than that. Saying that he wants her to grow up and be an honest person, he's saying that he hopes that she develops past that. But I think, based on what we were saying,
that could just be trauma and blocking certain things out.
Well, that could be too, yeah, but I don't know. So I don't blame her parents for what she did. And I think the one article that I mentioned at the beginning that was in the Toronto Times, I think it was Toronto Life, some people kind of attacked that author for saying that she made it sound like she gave Jennifer too much credit. But she was Jennifer's classmate, so she would have seen it more from her point of view.
Mm-hmm.
I think, I don't think, especially if she had that much money, she had so many other options. Absolutely. For what she could have done instead of having them murdered. She really could have run away and have them never find her with that much money. Yeah, regardless, it's a sad situation, and it shouldn't have happened. And we need better mental health services pretty much everywhere.
You know what I think would be great?
Hmm.
Two things, really. The stigma of getting psychological help be done away with.
It's gotten a lot better.
It's gotten better, but if people find out that you're on medication or you see a therapist or something, you can almost feel a judgment coming on from certain people.
Yeah.
And also, it shouldn't be like $500 an hour to get the help you need.
Yeah.
And while I know that is an exaggeration for the most part, it's still ridiculously expensive and a lot of insurance will not cover therapy.
No, and I've wanted to see a therapist for a long time and I can't afford it. But if you're having thoughts like that, please reach out to someone.
Absolutely.
Because, yeah, that's not a good thing, man.
No, and there are so many programs out there that if you're having issues, you can call them and they can put you in touch with someone who you can actually talk to.
Mm-hmm.
There are psychological programs out there for people that are in desperate need.
And if you hate your parents that much, go live with your friend Topaz. And don't kill them.
No. There's no reason to kill anyone, really.
Do you have anything we need to talk about? We're a quarter of the way to 10,000 listens, which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's insane. It's awesome. I'm loving it. Well, that about wraps it up.
Yeah.
For this week.
So, we love you guys.
Absolutely. Well, we love you so much for begging you not to kill your parents, no matter how mean they are to you, because it's better for you if you just leave that situation, leave that toxic situation, if that's how it's affecting you.
Yeah. And get a cat.
No, get a dog. Dogs will love you forever. Cats
get
can
a
be
cat
very...
and a dog, and but, name them Milo and Otis.
But cats can be very judgmental. I think it's time to go.
Check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter.
Twitter. We have all the Twitters.
All the Twitters. Email us at creepylifepodcast@gmail.com if you have a topic suggestion or a story. We'd love to do another listener episode, but we haven't got any new stories. So please consider doing that. But thank you for listening and for your support.
Thanks for listening, guys. You're awesome.
Stay creepy. Thank you.